You're listening to the Netmums podcast with me, Wendy Gollidge.
And me, Alison Perry. Coming up on this week's show...
We bought an epilator, a silk appeal epilator for £15 from the local newspaper, from a neighbour, disinfected it well. And then we got my auntie Lorraine, my Jamaican auntie, came round. And with my permission, they pinned me down and epilated my legs, like just the lower parts of my legs.
But before all of that,
this episode of the Netmamas podcast is brought to you by Aldi. Wendy, I've got a question for you. What's your guilty parenting pleasure?
Oh, I'd probably say it's gobbling up cold fish fingers from my kids' plates after they've abandoned dinner in favour of watching the telly.
I do that too. I reckon my guilty pleasure is sneaking out and escaping my children to have a lovely browse of my local Aldi alone.
I am so with you. What I love about Aldi is they have an excellent range of great value products. They even have an award-winning baby and toddler range, which includes weaning essentials, nappies and wipes.
It's funny you should say that, because another friend told me that she switched to Aldi Mamiya and it's giving her big savings.
Yes, plus with Netmums and Aldi, new parents can get a pack of newborn nappies absolutely free. So log on to our site and let your friends know about this awesome opportunity with Netmums and Aldi.
Right, don't tell my family, but I'm sneaking off to Aldi right now.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It's a blimmin' good job that this is a parenting podcast, I can tell you, because, oh, it's been a week. It's been a week as a parent. I've got a small one who's puking. I've got a big one who's moaning. I'm just done. I'm really done. And my husband's away, and I want to give a shout out to all of the other parents out there who have had just about a gutful this week already. Alison, you've had a bit of a week. Tell us. You've been fretting.
We've had a bit of a week. Yeah, I've been fretting because as we're recording this, it's the time of year when us parents find out about primary school places. My four-year-old twins, we don't live too far from primary school, but yeah, it was still a bit of a worry. So when that email came through the other day confirming that we have got places, it was like, ah, the relief. Yeah, we've got places, they're going to school.
I think the relief is just they're going to school. I've got some time, I've got some peace. Now, our lovely guest today is in the joys of toddlerhood. Tell us a little bit about the lady looking at us on the screen.
She is, yeah, she's not quite at primary school place stage yet, but our guest today is a regular face on the telly. Dr. Zoe Williams is an NHS doctor and is one of the resident GPs on ITV's This Morning. And she's also written a book, You Grow Girl, The Complete No Worries Guide to Growing Up, which is the ultimate growing up guide for girls aged 9+ who want to feel empowered, informed and positive about becoming the very best version of themselves. I don't know about 9-year-olds, but I feel like I could do with some of that advice myself. As mentioned, Zoe is a mum to a toddler, so how she's found time to join us today, I don't know. Welcome to the podcast, Zoe.
Oh, thank you, ladies. Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be talking on a parent podcast because I feel like I'm in good company, you understand.
So your little boy is 2, is that right?
It'll be 2 next month.
2 next month. So regular listeners will know that the toddler stage was my pinch point of parenting. I coined the phrase with friends, hashtag twatty toddlers, because toddlers, they don't do it for me. Toddlers just, they're just twats. Tell me, how are you finding the toddler stage? Some people love toddlers, hate babies. Some think babies are just squishy and delicious and toddlers are just annoying. Tell me. What do you think, toddlers?
Well, I found the baby stage really hard, actually, especially the newborn baby stage. And I think I was expecting all this sort of joy, and there was some of that, but I found it really hard, and I felt like I had a lot of anxiety. I feel like now in the toddler stage, it's just a whole new set of challenges. My anxiety is definitely less because I don't feel like he's going to die every second, whilst actually the reality is he does try to kill himself almost every second.
But can I just say how comforting it is that a GP, a doctor, has just said to us, Alison, that she was worried that her baby was going to die all the time, because the rest of us do that too.
Yeah, I thought that was a normal people thing, not a GP thing.
I think being a GP in some ways it made it easier. You know, when he got unwell, I knew what medication to give him, and I was sort of able to, at one point, I mean, he got COVID and he was quite poorly, but I was able to properly assess his heart rate and breathing rate and capillary refill time. I had all those skills to like assess him really well. But also it does, having that awareness and that knowledge of all the horrible things, you know, your brain does sometimes go to worst case scenario. And I think for me, the anxiety was perhaps less about the physical things, but also about, I don't know, when he used to cry, I would literally leap off the sofa, run upstairs and be there in 5 seconds. If it was Stuart's turn to go up, I'd sit there trying to be calm, being like, why are you not charging up the stairs? Because I think I had this like inherent fear that if we weren't there immediately, he'd feel like we'd left him or left him on his own. And yeah, I was a bit crazy in the early days, a little bit. But I think, you know, that's very, very normal. And now he's a toddler and he is actually trying to, I mean, he just jumped off the table the other day randomly and managed to land quite well. And the fourth time he hurt himself and he says, road, car, and then runs into the road. So I think now, you know, he's dangerous. He's really dangerous. But I'm somehow more relaxed.
It's weird, isn't it? It's interesting hearing you talk about the difference between you and your partner's kind of attitude towards him. I wonder whether that kind of anxious checking on your baby thing, is that kind of like an inbuilt mum thing? I don't know.
I think it is. I've, in order to sort of rationalise all of this, which is what my brain tends to do, I've done a lot of thinking about, I guess, our ancestors and, you know, a couple of hundred years ago, when we did have very much defined roles as mothers and fathers, and the mother's role was to keep the baby safe and nurture and protect, whereas the father's role was more to provide. And obviously the world has completely changed, but our genetics that are imprinted haven't. And I think that's perhaps why as women we tend to worry much more and be more concerned. And, you know, dads come in and sort of swing them around the head and throw them around and they're fine with it. And I think there is some research that's shown that actually same-sex couples, when it's same-sex couples and when it's two male parents, they do start to take on more of that maternal, sometimes one of them or both of them will take on more of those sort of maternal characteristics, which is really, really interesting that our sort of brains can change depending on the role that we perceive that we have.
So how do you and your partner, Stuart, juggle and split things? Obviously, you're worrying about it. He's totally chilled. But in terms of the practical things, do you sort of split jobs like bedtime, mealtimes, or do you just kind of do it depending on who's around?
We're pretty much 50. I think it's never 50-50. It's as close to 50-50 as I think it can be. So every day is different in our house. So Mondays we're both in work. So usually he does the nursery drop off and then his nursery teacher actually brings him home from nursery and does dinner, bath and bedtime. And we pay her to do that because we don't have any family around us for support. So it is just the two of us. So she helps us on a Monday. And I think because we don't have that family support around us, we're fine. We've got it sorted. But if anything goes wrong, if he has a temperature, then it all falls apart. And, you know, that's when I just dread anything going wrong. And there was one day we were both out of town and I just had this real surge of fear, the anxiety. Like it was really awful, like almost a panic attack thinking, what if he gets unwell? What are we going to do? Neither of us can get there. And, you know, that's when you resort to ringing the next door neighbour and saying, help.
So Zoe, you've spoken before about how you received some judgment about your parenting on social media. Does that stress you out or have you learned to take it all in your stride? How do you manage it?
It doesn't stress me out. I think because of the job that I do and the things and the topics that I talk about on This Morning and on my social platforms around health, I think I had to, and I've been doing that for around 10 years now, I think I had to learn, come up with a strategy quite early on as to how I was going to deal with criticism, because it's inevitable that, you know, not everybody is going to agree with the NHS advice or what I'm saying, or especially when it comes to topics like vaccinations. And I'm not just talking COVID vaccinations, but childhood vaccinations. So I kind of had to early on think, right, well, how am I going to manage this? And I often advise other TV doctors or colleagues when they get criticism. And I think often that there's two things I do. The first thing I do is, have a look at, if there's 1,000 comments and 995 of them are positive and saying, thank you for sharing that, that's helpful, and 5 are really, really vulgar. You know, I've had things like, you're trying to kill children, you're a murderer, all sorts of like crazy stuff. Just remember in your brain that that's a very tiny percentage, and actually you're doing a lot of good. And the other thing I try and remember is, you know, often people say, especially very, very cruel things. I try and just have some empathy and sympathy for them and not take it personally, not let it hurt me. You know, this is a complete stranger. If I were to meet them in the street, would they say this? Absolutely not. And what's happened in their day? What are they going through for them to feel the need to release such anger and fury, and try and feel a bit of sympathy for them? And those are the two things that I've done. So when it came to getting a bit of criticism for my parenting choices, because I think however you parent, whatever you do, somebody's going to criticize. If you're sharing it on social media, you know, somebody's going to think differently. I just use those same principles. I just thought, you know what, people are entitled to their opinion. That's absolutely fine if that's how you want to parent. But I'm quite happy with the choices and decisions that I'm making. I feel like I'm bringing up my child the way I want to. I'm doing a good job, and it's safe.
So you've talked about how growing up, you had a few bumps in the road with some missed school due to some health issues and occasionally feeling like you were the odd one out because you were the only black girl in the school. So you know what it's like to not have a brilliant time growing up. Is that what prompted your book?
Yeah. So, I mean, I feel like those preteen years, sort of from the ages of 9 to 13, for girls, it's always been the same. For all of us women, we've been through it, and it's a really difficult time. Even for those that have an easy time, it's a difficult time. And I feel like it's so much harder now for lots of reasons with social media. And I think one of the big changes is that when we were young, you know, we had limited resources to find answers to our questions. So if we wanted to know about self-pleasure, or if we wanted to know about how you insert a tampon, or we wanted to know about sex, you know, we could ask our parents, we could try and find a book in the library, or as I shared in the book, I have these little overshare moments. I used to sort of read the leaflet in my mum's tampon box over and over and over again, because I was just obsessed with learning how to insert a tampon. But now it's different, because they can go online and they can find good resources, you know, if they go to NHS websites, for example, but also they can find really dodgy resources. And, you know, the way that I think young girls can, anybody can access things like porn, it's just there, it's available. And what is that, you know, what are they there for them believing? So in this book, I felt that there was a gap in the market. Whilst there are great books out there for puberty, I don't really think there was one that's suitable for modern times. And I think also, I don't think there was one that's completely honest about a lot of stuff that, whilst we might think, well, it's not, is it really suitable for a girl aged 9 to 13 to be reading a book that talks a little bit briefly about things like self-pleasure and sex? It's like, well, I think it is, because those questions come up and they're going to find that information from somewhere. So in this book, it's safe, it's reliable, it's factually correct, it's scientifically correct. And the way I've written the book, it's kind of like me as a friend, as a bit of a guide, helping them. So it's a book they can read cover to cover, but also a book they can come back to a later day, you know, when things come up. And a lot of it is about confidence, empowerment, self-care, and loving yourself and the body that you're in.
Yeah, like you say, it does feel like we've come on such a long way since we were all growing up and at that age, doesn't it? What kind of advice did you get growing up, and where did you go for advice apart from the tampon instruction leaflets?
I'm just going to butt in. It was Judy Blume's Forever for me.
Yes, I remember that back.
Do you remember that? Are you too young, Dr. Zoe? Do you remember that book?
I don't know that one.
Oh, Ralph.
Ralph. Yes. Anyone listen? They're all too young, Alison. There's a book by an American author. She was called Judy Blume, and she was a very forward author. She did a book all about starting periods, but they were fiction. And Forever was about your first encounter with the male sex. And there were some well-thumbed copies in my school.
Well-thumbed, especially one page yeah. in particular.
I do recall Judy Blume, but it's a very vague memory. But, ooh. Good one.
There's a big film coming out about one of her books, Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, which is all about starting periods and boobs. And yeah, it's definitely worth checking out.
Those things are covered in the book, but I've kind of gone one step further with periods. You know, I talk about the four P's, so puberty, periods, pregnancy, and perimenopause. And, you know, in the book, I do talk a little bit about menopause because I hear so many women who are experiencing symptoms of perimenopause, menopause for the first time, and they have no idea. They've never thought about it. They don't know about it. And things like osteoporosis, you know, I treat lots of ladies who have osteoporosis, and actually it's in our teenage years that we're able to lay down good strong bones. So I talk about that in the book as well. And in periods, I talk about so I've shared this. I've got one copy. I've only got one copy here. And I was with some of my friends this weekend, and I took it and showed it to them, and they were reading it. And there was a lot of things in there that I was saying, I didn't know this. I didn't know that that was the anatomy of the clitoris. I didn't know that actually the external parts of our genitalia are the vulva, not the vagina, and that there are four phases to our menstrual cycle. And one of the things I really like in the book is I talk about, you know, periods starting, when periods go wrong, heavy periods, painful periods, but also about the normal menstrual cycle and how it has four different phases and how each phase has kind of got its pitfalls, but also its superpowers. So that girls can think, right, I can hack my cycle. You know, if I'm an athlete, the second week of my menstrual cycle is when I'm most likely to get a personal best. The first week is when my pain threshold is lower, and therefore that's why I get headaches. The fourth week, that's when I feel really low in mood. But knowing actually this is only going to last a week and this is the reason why can be really empowering. So yeah, just going that one step further. But yeah, back to your question about where did I get my information from? I mean, my mum was always somebody who wanted to be very proactive at telling me stuff. I didn't necessarily want to receive the information from her, but she didn't hold back. You know, she was always naked in front of us, and, you know, she'd always be showing me, these are my stretch marks and this is what I got when I had you. And I'd see her putting in a tampon when I was in the bath. And so, you know, I think that was really helpful that she was very open, and I knew I could ask her anything, but I didn't really want to hear it from her. So I probably did often try to find it out on my own secretly. So in things like books or leaflets, or I remember Always Ultra, that was around the time that they first came into existence, and they used to send out these little packs for months and months and months. You could ring up, I think you had to ring up then and give them your address, and they'd send you like a starter pack. So I had about 20 like of these starter packs. I was a bit obsessed. I started my periods a bit later than most of my friends, so I was kind of a bit obsessed with being prepared. But then I think really, for a lot of the questions that I had, a lot of the things I wanted to find out, me and my friends would discuss it and try and figure it out for ourselves, but we didn't really have a good source of information.
I think that is very true.
Position of the Fortnight in...
Yeah.
Was that... Which magazine was that?
More Magazine, Zoe. I used to work on More Magazine. So was part of the team who would come up with Position of the Fortnight, which is one of my claims to fame.
Yeah, so that was just so exciting. Like, oh my God, you can have sex in this position. Cowgirl, wow, that sounds funny. Way before, you know, I was even interested in actually having sex, I wanted to know about it.
Yeah, all of that stuff was so important. But yeah, I guess teenagers today don't have magazines like we had back in the day, even more so why there's such a massive need for books like yours.
But also because, as you say, it's gone the other way. They've gone from us kind of trying to get the information from the tampon pack to them having every bit of information at their fingertips, but not always the right information and not always safe information.
Yeah, I completely agree. And it's impossible for, I mean, my child's little, as we've talked about, but my friends who have older children, it's impossible to know exactly where they're going online. Although there are ways to try and have some parental control, it's impossible to know exactly what they're looking at. And the first time I saw porn, I think I was only about 12 or 13. And there was one boy in our class whose parents were out at work all day, and he lived around the corner from school, and he'd managed to somehow get hold of this porn tape. So we'd all go around to his house. There'd be like 15 of us in his living room at lunchtime watching this same porn tape over and over and over again. So, you know, I start to think, well, that's what sex is supposed to be like. And that's what penises look like. And that's what vulvas look like. And, you know, it is worrying, I think, that children can access any information online that can, you know, sort of tamper with their ideas of what reality is.
Now, Wendy and I both have girls. Mine's 12, Wendy's is 11, and it can be tricky for us to know how to chat to them. Like you were saying, Zoe, when you were that age, you didn't want to necessarily get information from your mum. My little girl, she cringes whenever I bring up anything body related. She's like, oh my goodness, so cringe. What advice do you have for chatting to girls about their bodies?
I think it's really important that they know that that door is open for them to have a conversation at any time. But I think it is really, really when your parents bring it up. So a few tips would be, if you feel that there's a conversation that needs to be had, giving a warning shot, first of all. So say, for example, I don't know, you've spotted that there's breast buds, or you know, you want to bring up the conversation about a bra for the first time. I think sort of giving a little bit of a warning shot, saying, oh, you know, tomorrow we're going here, and I'm thinking when we're in the car we'll have a bit of time to have a chat about things like bras and crop tops, and I'm wondering if your friends have started. So giving a warning shot beforehand, so you're not kind of surprising them with it. Then I think having a conversation in a car is a really good place, because it's less intense. There's a bit of music on in the background, you can look out the window, no eye contact, and it's okay if there are pauses. I think over the dinner table directly, it can be quite pressured. Whereas, you know, next day in the car saying, oh, remember I said we could talk a bit about bras, and then try and be open, let them lead, say, you know, what you're thinking about that, and let them lead with it. If they shut it down, they're just like, mum, no, don't want to talk about it, it's too awkward, just say, fine, that's okay. But you can bring it up at any time. And maybe I'll bring it up again in a couple of weeks. And here's Dr. Zoe's book.
This is my parenting from here on in. Here you are, Chloe. Here's Dr. Zoe's book. Off you pop.
But I think also asking them, is there someone else that you'd rather have this conversation with? You know, maybe if there's one of your friends, or, you know, a cousin, or an older relative, then, you know, asking to say, would you find it easier to have this conversation with somebody else? And you might be able to get one of your mates to do it. There's a couple of people I know through working in TV, actually, who homeschool, and they've sort of said, when it comes to the sex education bit, would you mind helping out? It was sort of in lockdown. Would you do like a bit of a Zoom call lesson? I'll do the lesson plan, just because they don't want to hear it from me. And, you know, so sometimes maybe if there's somebody in the family or a friend that they feel more comfortable with, then you can hand it over to them or do it together and make it a lesson, like a formal lesson.
That's all very well if you're their friend. I'm just thinking of my group of friends and can you imagine ringing up your mate saying, right, today you're doing pubes, please, off you go.
I think for me, if my mum would have asked me that, it would have been my cousin, Claudette, who was about 12 years older than me, and she used to babysit for us. And she was just hilarious. She was just really, really funny. And I could just imagine her coming into babysit and saying, right, your mum's made me talk to you about, your mum said I've got to talk to you about your boobs today, so let's just get it done with. And I'd have felt comfortable doing that with her more than my mum, I think.
Yeah. The other thing that feels different about your book is that you cover very openly sexuality, blended families, and mental health, which are all things that wouldn't have been covered in a book when we were younger. And they all feel really important topics for our kids today.
Yeah. I mean, I think when I was writing the book, and I worked with my editor really carefully at the beginning to define what the chapters would be, and I wanted to make sure that I included all the things that I feel really passionately about. So, you know, there are things when we talk about managing periods, it's not just tampons and towels. We talk about various other ways as well. So period pants and moon cups, but also we talk about period poverty and what if 1 in 10 girls have financial difficulties, which mean that they find it difficult to access products for their periods. So there's support for how to go about that. Talk about food insecurity, because that's something that I experienced growing up. You know, we really struggled financially at certain times. So tips and tricks for food insecurity and prejudice, you know, whether you feel that you're being subjected to it or just that understanding. So we talk a little bit about racism and how, you know, I try to talk about it in a way that everybody can understand that racism has got a really, you know, it's a negative thing. It's a bad thing. But actually, we all have prejudices. We all come into this world and we have lived experiences that means that we will view people who we don't understand and who are different to us in a different way. So how we can kindly overcome that and actually turn it into a positive and be curious about people and how we can call out prejudice or bullying when we see it, how we all have a responsibility, whether we're the bully, the person being bullied or the person witnessing it, you know, we all have a responsibility to do something about that. But I think what I tried to thread throughout the book is this idea of kindness. And actually, if somebody is a bully, there's probably a reason why. And if we can sort of look with a bit like when I was saying, when I get trolled on Instagram, I try and just be empathetic and think with kindness and think, well, actually, it's probably because of what that person's going through. So hopefully I think what people will take away from it, you know, it's a puberty book, but puberty is not just about bodily changes. It's about emotional changes. It's about relationship changes. But also for girls in particular at this age, it's about staying safe, it's being safe online, body image. And, you know, a lot of the book is about, there are sort of tips and tricks and little challenges in there to try and help empower and give confidence. So an example would be, I was a gladiator back 10, just, well, it's more than that now, 2008, 2009. I ended up being a gladiator on the show. I was Amazon. And I was someone, even at that time in my life, I wasn't that confident. I'm still not that confident. But I found that standing and pulling a particular pose for the cameras, which I had to do, sort of made me feel confident. So there's one little challenge in there, which is I challenge girls to come up with their own gladiator name and come up with their own gladiator pose. And I suggest one where, you know, you push your chest slightly forward, put your hands on your hips, stand with your feet slightly apart, because there is scientific evidence to say the way that we hold ourselves can actually make us feel more confident. So then I say, you know, if you're feeling like you're lacking confidence, if you've got to stand up and give a talk at school or, you know, somebody's, what you can do in your mind is remind yourself of your gladiator name. Maybe not stand with your hands on your hip, but shift your body slightly in that direction to remind yourself and just embody that gladiator person and give yourself confidence in the moment. So there's loads of like takeaway tips and tricks and challenges in there that I really hope will be helpful.
I've actually heard there's a TED talk about doing that. Like if you have a job interview, obviously this is more for grown-ups, but like nip to the loo, do the hands on hips stance before the interview, and actually it does help. So for our kids, telling them to nip to the loos in schools and stand like that if they need to too.
Absolutely. And then the other little challenge is we all have an inner critic. And I think, you know, as grown-ups, we kind of are aware that we have this negative voice inside our heads that can sometimes disempower us and tell us that we're not good enough and make us fearful. But I think young people don't really comprehend that, don't understand that. So I challenge them to create this little troll, like draw a little troll that's their little inner troll, and be kind to it because it's there to protect you. At the end of the day, it's there to protect you from situations where you might end up in danger or you might embarrass yourself, but it's a little bit over the top and overreacts a lot of the time. So this is about having mantras, sort of, you know, yet my mantra when I was growing up was always, I had to tell myself, yes, I can. I still do. Sometimes sit on the sofa on TV and I feel nervous. So I just go, yes, I can, yes, I can, yes, I can, yes, I can. And then I feel better. So it's about saying to that little troll, thank you for showing up and trying to protect me today. But do you know what? I've got this. Yes, I can. And then visualize yourself just sipping its mouth closed and, you know, keeping it close to you to protect you. But you can overpower it at any time. Because I think that's the thing young people need. I've learned as I've got older, lots of sort of psychological techniques. I've had cognitive behavioral therapy and I've learned all of this, but I've tried to come up with like little games, activities and tips and tricks that young people can utilize to get the same benefit.
Forget young people. I need to go and draw a troll. This is good stuff. I'm in. Teenage and tweeny girls, they get a bit of a bad rap, don't they? You know, everyone says to you when you've got a, I don't know if you had this, Alison, but if you've got like an 8-9-year-old, they're like, oh, it's coming, and it's just you wait. But what are the best things about teenage girls, Zoe?
I mean, I feel like I should divert that question back to you. What are the best things about your tweens?
It's just the way they attack everything for me. They just attack everything with gusto. That's what I like.
I love the fact, and we've already talked about this, Wendy, you almost get to relive parts of your own teen years. So I've been watching Twilight and The Hunger Games with my 12-year-old, and it's just really lovely to kind of relive that through her eyes, and they're old enough to kind of do fun stuff with you. So that's really good.
I think mostly my experience is working with girls this age in schools. So I've done a lot of work going into schools in disadvantaged areas and working with girls and encouraging them to do physical activity, but also doing workshops with them to build confidence. And I think the thing I love about them is that they're so smart. I think we underestimate just how smart, how intelligent, and they're absolute sponges. Like, they can just soak up information in a way that we can't. I think often the thing in a school setting anyway, which is where my experience is, often the thing that is lacking is they deserve to be just given a little bit more autonomy and empowerment. Because actually, when they're given that, they'll do sensible things with it. And I'll give you an example. We were working with a group of girls in a school in quite a deprived area in Essex. And we did this physical activity workshop with them. And it was a deprived area, but this incredible school that had the most amazing gym. And we were working with the girls who had disengaged from physical activity and chose not to do PE and didn't want to participate in PE. And at the end of the session, we said to them, you know, what would it take for you to be in that gym and using that gym? Because you've said that it's a great gym. You said you like it and you said you'd actually like to use it. Well, they said, well, if there could be one day after school that it was girls only, then we'd stick around and we'd use it. So their PE teacher was sat there right in front of them. So I looked at their PE teacher and she said, well, which day? They said, they looked at each other, they went, Thursday? The PE teacher went, done. And that was it. So they made this pact that they were going to use the gym every Thursday after school. They were going to encourage their friends or the girls to come and use it as well. And it would be a girls only session. And, you know, that was just simply just handing over a little bit of power to them. And that's what came from it. So I think we sometimes underestimate that girls sort of in this age group, sort of 9+ up to teens, they're super smart. And they're absolute sponges at absorbing information, and what they can then do to transform that information into positive action. Perhaps sometimes we don't give them the opportunity to do that.
Yeah, that's so true. Now, I saw a conversation on Facebook the other day. It was a mum of a 9-year-old girl, and she was asking about shaving her legs, and the mum was unsure what advice to give her. And I think back to when my daughter was having that conversation with me, and I felt like I should be saying to her, you don't need to shave your legs, boys don't shave them, you know, equality and all that. But then another part of me was like, I remember what it was like to have hairy legs and feel self-conscious about it. So how do we get that balance of what we think we should be telling our daughters and the reality of what we think it's looking to be like for them?
Well, this is where I think they deserve to receive the information so that they can make an informed choice. And I think that means them having the whole range of options for that scenario explained to them, everything from, well, actually, you know, some people don't shave their legs, and that's absolutely fine. There's no reason to shave your legs except for cosmetic purposes. But then a lot of people do. And if you want to, then these are the various different ways we can think about hair removal. And there are some pros and cons to each one. So if you shave your legs, that's sort of the quickest, easiest, cheapest way probably, but the hairs are likely to come back thicker and darker over time. So it might not be the best reason for that. Then there's waxing, but you know, that can be very expensive if you're going to do it professionally, or very messy and can be quite painful. There's an epilator, you know, so on and so forth. What happened to me, my mum used to always, so my mum was white, my dad's black. She had quite fair skin and dark hair. So she used to go and get her legs waxed and I used to go with her. And she used to always say to me, whatever you do, never shave your legs. When you want to shave your legs, come to me and we'll find a way to deal with it. So I got to the stage where I wanted to. And so in the end, what we did, we bought an epilator, a silk appeal epilator for £15 from the local newspaper, from a neighbour, disinfected it well. And then we got my auntie Lorraine, my Jamaican auntie, came round. And with my permission, they pinned me down and epilated my legs, like just the lower parts of my legs. They barely ever grew back. So the second time they did it, it was much easier because half of them didn't grow back. And then the third time, and then, I mean, now I shave my legs about once every 2 months. They barely grew back. So then I thought, right, I'm going to epilate my armpits as well and my bikini line when I got a bit older and wanted to do those. And I did. And eventually the hairs barely grew back. Now I've been and had lasering, which I think, you know, lasering is the ultimate hair removal. But it's quite expensive, but actually works out probably about the same price as having professional waxing, and bearing in mind it's a more permanent solution. So yeah, to answer your question, I think, you know, girls are smart, and I was put off shaving my legs because my mum terrified me that I'd end up, you know, with really, really hairy, thick, hairy legs. So in the book, we talk about that. So talk about all the options, including doing nothing, and the pros and cons of each, so that then they can make their own decision, and whatever the outcomes of that are long term, you know, they're you know, it's their choice, and they knew. So if they do decide to shave and then their legs get really hairy, you know, I think it's much more it's much easier to, it's like when we do, you know, if we do surgery in medicine, that's why we do a consent form, because sometimes there are risks. But if you knew about that risk and you consented and you had awareness before, it's much easier psychologically to deal with.
I think what's the lesson here is for the parent almost, because I find it hard as a mum to sometimes let her make those choices, knowing that she's making the wrong choice, and giving them the autonomy to make that wrong choice and own it is a really tricky thing to do as a parent of a child of that age. It's a bit different when they're two and you're kind of, you know, they need to eat something and they don't want to. And you kind of like that, the battle's a bit different. Do you find that autonomy hard, Alison?
I do think it's funny, actually. I think I'm a bit unusual because I feel quite strongly that she should have strong body autonomy. Like, I've had conversations with my mum friends who've got kids the same age. Like, if my daughter doesn't want to shower one day or wash her hair and she ends up with really greasy hair, I'm a bit like, just let her get on with it because it's her body. I do encourage her and I do say, do you think you might want to wash your hair today? But if she refuses, I'm not going to march her into the shower. Whereas some of my mum friends are like, no, 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 it's really important to be clean. And they'll have kind of arguments with their kids, get them in the shower, get them to wash their hair. I don't know. Like, where do you stand on that, Zoe? Is there a line where you need to step in and force your kids to shower?
I think, well, to some extent, it depends on the child, doesn't it? You know, there are some children who, you know, and I'm not here to tell anyone how to parent, and it's so unique and it really does depend on your child. But I think actually my initial response to that is, if your daughter doesn't shower on that particular day and doesn't wash her hair and her hair's a bit greasy and maybe she's got a bit of BO and then she goes to school that day and somebody comments, then she's learned that lesson for herself and it's done. Probably from then on forward, you never have that battle again, because she's going to think, actually, life is just easier if I do shower. Same with brushing your teeth, isn't it? You know, I remember I was battling with my mum about brushing my teeth. I never wanted to brush them. So she said one day, she said, fine, don't brush your teeth then. And all day my mouth felt disgusting. And I thought, from now on forwards, I will always brush my teeth. So I think letting children make mistakes and being there to pick them up and support them and explain when it's something like not washing your hair, you know, it's not going to kill them. It's not a major issue. They'll get over it. You're almost building them up and preparing them for when they have decisions a little bit later on where making the wrong decision has more significant consequences. So I would say in general, I think, yeah, helping, supporting them through their mistakes rather than stopping them from making mistakes will have some benefits, because at some point we all have to learn from our mistakes and we all have to, that's how we develop our lives.
Could you come and move in with me? Please, just, could you come and move in? I feel like I would be a better mum if you were just there.
I mean, but this is it. I have to, I'm not a parenting expert, and one day I'll have a teenager and I might do it all differently because there's no right or wrong. So I guess I'm really coming at this.
But you talk the talk, Zoe. You sound better at it than me.
I'm going to fight you for her, Wendy. Now, Zoe, if you could go back and tell 10-year-old Zoe one piece of advice, what would it be?
Oh, I think it would be to look in the mirror and treat yourself with at least as much kindness as you treat the other people in your life that you love. It's like the most important relationship you'll ever have with anyone is with yourself, and you deserve to treat yourself with the same love and respect that you do your best friends and your parents, because I definitely didn't. And I think, yeah, that's probably the most valuable life lesson I could have taught 10-year-old me.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been so great to chat to you.
Thank you so much for having me, ladies. And I love your podcast.
We've loved having you on.
Thank you very much. Bye.
Bye.